Okay, Parshas Re'eh, page 998 in the Chumashim. Parshas Re'eh has many different things, as all the Parshas do in Sefer Dvarim. Moshe Rabbeinu continues on his preparation for Klal Yisrael to go into the land of Eretz Yisrael, warns them about various different foundations and fundamentals of Yiddishkeit. So we have various different things coming in the Parsha, and we're going to try just and highlight a few. So the Pasuk begins, we'll just do the first few Pesukim, and then we'll skip to some other things. So Moshe Rabbeinu begins, Re'eh, Anoichi Noisein Lifneichem Hayoim. He says, see. He says to the Bnei Yisrael, see, have a look. Anoichi Noisein Lifneichem Hayoim, I am placing before you today, Brocha Uklola, blessing and curse. Esa Brocha, the blessing, Asher Tishmu El Mitzvois Hashem Alakecha, the blessing will come when you listen to Hashem, the commandments of Hashem your God, Asher Anoichi Metzav Eschem Hayoim, that I'm commanding you today. V'haklala and the curse, im lois ishmu, if you will not listen, al mitzvahis Hashem alakechem, you will not listen to the mitzvahs of Hashem your God, v'sartem min haderech, and you will stray from the way, asher anoichi mitzav eschem hayoim, that I am commanding you today, v'leches acharei alakim acharim asher lo yadaitem, to follow foreign gods that you have not known. Then he continues and he says, it will come to pass when you will come, when Hashem your God will bring you to the land Asher Atova Shamal Rishta, that you are coming there to inherit. Venosato Esabrocha al Har Grizim, you will give the blessing on the mountain of Grizim, Vesaklala al Har Evil, and the curse on the mountain of Evil. What this is talking about, of course, is that when the Klal Yisrael went into the land of Israel, they had to, one of the first things they did was to establish the beginning of their spiritual journey in the land of Israel. They were together. Six tribes went on one mountain of Har Grizim, six tribes went on Har Evil. The Levim stood in the middle, and the Yidden accepted upon themselves the covenant once again of Torah and Mitzvahs. The Levim, this is spoken about later in Parshas Kisavoy, the Levim faced the one mountain and said all the blessings, faced the other mountain and said all the curses. And that was the display of the concept of reward and punishment, blessing and curse, etc. Just a couple of things that I wanted to highlight on this part of the parsha. First of all, it's interesting that Moshe Rabbeinu uses the term Re'eh, which also is the name of the parsha, right? We don't find this anywhere else. Even in Sefer Dvarim, which is the style of parsha, Sefer Dvarim is somewhat different to the first four books. We don't normally see this. We have it a few times. We don't see this rule, Re'eh, see. We say, Hine, behold, V'ata, now. Moshe Rabbeinu spoke to the Jewish people and told them the following. But he starts with a proclamation, declaration, says, Re'eh, see. Right? One of the reasons this is because it's not just, and also, what were they seeing? Right? It wasn't showing them anything, it was just saying, see. And one of the explanations given for this is as follows. That there's various ways that we can serve Hashem. There's various ways we can serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu and do Torah mitzvahs, right? Sometimes we do it just out of obedience. In other words, we have questions. We're not filled with conviction. We're not enthusiastic. But we know that it's right, so we just do it. Right. Sometimes it's much more than that. Sometimes we're convinced, we have passion, we have enthusiasm, sometimes we have the logic, we have the rationale, we understand, we convince, we have logical proofs. And that logical proof adds to the excitement of learning Torah and doing mitzvahs. And that's obviously a high level. But even if someone understands, it doesn't always mean that if someone understands something, that they have full level of conviction. Right? Conviction is something where you're absolutely clear. You're absolutely not just convinced, but you're absolutely, for you it's clear as day. There's no doubt, right? So what Moshe Rabbeinu is saying to the Jewish people is this. He's saying to them, Re'eh, from what I'm about to tell you in terms of you being motivated to choose blessing over the opposite, to choose blessing over the negative, and that's all to do with our free choice and choosing the right path and choosing to serve Hashem over not serving Hashem, it shouldn't just be something you do out of obedience. If it has to be, then it is. But the optimum level, the ideal level of serving HaKadosh Baruch Hu is a level of Re'eh. Re'eh means see. What does see mean? There's nothing more certain to a person than when they see something. Right? When we see something, then it's absolute clarity. We know this, right? If I convince you that there's something in the other room, and I convince you with scientific proof that is beyond a shadow of a doubt, you'll believe me. And it will be clear to you that it exists. But at the back of your mind, there always exists a possibility that it's not true. Even though you fully understand it, you understand it at a very deep level, but you've never seen it. So as much as convinced as you might be, there always exists the possibility, the remote possibility that perhaps it's not true. A Jew reaches a level of belief in Hashem that is much deeper than that. Now that comes from Matan Torah, really. Because Matan Torah is when we saw, we were exposed, we were absolutely revealed to us. Right? The level of clarity and the level of certainty that the Jewish people reached when the Torah was given was a certainty that can be compared to someone seeing something. There was no room for doubt, right? Which is, by the way, why, and we've discussed this on the Mondays, but it's why our whole identity is taken from the giving of the Torah at Har Sinai. Because that's when we became Hashem's nation, that's where we reached the level of absolute clarity and absolute certainty. Now, Moshe Rabbeinu is talking to the nation that's about to go into Eretz Yisrael. This is the generation that didn't see Matan Torah. Right? That's the whole idea, because the book of Devarim is 40 years down the track. The book of Devarim is when Moshe Rabbeinu talks to the generation that their fathers died out because of the decree of not being able to go into the land of Eretz Yisrael. So, this is their children. They're about to go into a new land. This is the children that, number one, did not see what their father saw. And they're also about to go into a land where God will not be as obvious as he was in the desert. The desert was completely spiritual. The man fell every day. The clouds laundered their clothing. Right? Clarity of being connection. Conviction wasn't hard in the desert. But it will be hard in the land of Eretz Yisrael, Moshe Rabbeinu tells you. Because you're going to go into a land, you're going to have to work, you're going to have to, things won't fall from heaven, you're going to have to plow the field, you have to sow the seeds, you have to live a pretty physical, mundane lifestyle. God is not going to be that obvious. So he warns the Jewish people, he says, what I'm putting before you today is not just a choice. And I'm not just asking you to choose blessing over the other. Right? But I'm asking you, Re'eh, bring yourself to a level of conviction, a level of certainty, as if you've seen. And that's the power of a Jew. A power a Yid has, we all have within ourselves, within our neshamas, a level of clarity. Just sometimes it's hidden. Right? There's a chazal. Chazal tell us there's an expression, Yisrael ma'aminim b'nei ma'aminim. Jewish people are intrinsically believers, the sons of believers. In other words, a Jew believes with a level of absolute conviction and certainty. The only problem is, sometimes it's hidden. And that's why Rabbi Shabbani is saying, hey, bring it out. Bring it out the level of sight. Bring out the level of conviction that it should be as if you see it, and therefore when you make that choice between bracha and the other, it's completely clear by you. Let's move on to something else, and maybe we'll come back to this if we have time. I'm going to try and just focus on something that perhaps we haven't touched on. Oh, sorry, it's a boy. Oh, okay. Do you turn it to the Shabbos switch? Oh.
Sorry, I've been playing with the switch. I switched it off again, so I'll switch it back on. Sorry.
It's okay.
Okay, I want to turn to something that perhaps is like more of a detailed thing, but it's a part of the parasha that perhaps we haven't dealt with before. And it's Perek Yud Gimel. Let me just find it. Hold on a second. Yeah, page 106. two of the 613 mitzvahs that need a bit of clarification. Pasuk Aleph, verse 1. Right? Chapter 13, verse 1, Perek Yudgimel, Pasuk Aleph. Torah says, one of the things that Moshe Rabbeinu tells the Jewish people in this week's parasha is as follows. It's also spoken about in last week's parasha. This is not working, this thing. Okay. Let's go. Okay, says the Pasuk. Eis kol ha-dovar asher anochi mitzava eschem. Everything I command you, in other words, all of the mitzvahs, says God, that I give you, oisoi sishmeru la'asois, that is what you should protect and do. In other words, you should fulfill all the mitzvahs. And then he says, lo soisef olav v'lo sigra mimenu. Do not add to the mitzvahs and do not take away from the mitzvahs. And this becomes enumerated as two of the 613 mitzvahs. There's a commandment not to add to the mitzvahs and not to take away from mitzvahs. Right? Interesting, I saw a little vort. Why does the Torah first say not to add and then not to take away? Surely not taking away is worse, right? And also you'd imagine that people would be rather tempted to take away from the mitzvahs than to add to the mitzvahs. Adding to the mitzvahs means you've got to do more. Taking away means you get out of responsibility, right? So wouldn't the Torah warn first, don't take away, and then it should say, even don't even add, but don't take away. So I saw a vort, because the Yetzer Hara never starts with a person to take away. The person's committed to Torah mitzvahs, the Yetzer Hara knows, doesn't stand a chance to tell the person to take away from the mitzvahs. So you know, one of the tactics, so to speak, of the Yetzer Hara is, tells the person to add to the mitzvahs. And the Gemara says, kol ha-moisiv gerer, when you start tempering with the mitzvahs, when you add, it's like taking away. Once you start adding, it'll be easy to get you to take away. So the first strategy, the Torah warns you, the first strategy is going to be, you're going to be tempted to add. And then it'll lead to taking away. All right. But what does this actually mean? So let's have a look first at this mitzvah about not taking away from the mitzvahs. Not adding to the mitzvahs, I mean. Because if we think about it for a moment, we actually do add to the mitzvahs in many ways. Can you think of examples? Take sukkahs, for example, right? There's a mitzvah to shake a lulav. How many days? How many days?
7 days.
No? The Torah doesn't say 7 days. The Torah says only 1 day. Only 1 day. The Torah says, Olakachtem lochem b'yom rishon. He takes you the first day. Only the first day it's a mitzvah. Right? And in the Beis HaMikdash, it was a mitzvah for 7 days. Says the Gemara, when the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, one of the great sages, instituted that as a zeichel l'mikdash, to remember the Beis HaMikdash, we should have a mitzvah and do it every single day of Sukkot. Every single day of Sukkot, we take the lulav and we say, Asher kiddush shana b'mitzvah yisav tzivot. Right? So we add to the mitzvah. So are we allowed to add or not allowed to add? What's the story? Many examples. Second day yontif. Right? Second day yontif, by the way, involves adding to the mitzvahs and taking away from the mitzvahs. We who live in Chutz La'aretz have an obligation to keep second day yontif. Which means, first of all, that we have to add mitzvahs. We eat matzah on the second night Pesach. Torah says eat matzah 1 night. We say eat matzah 2 nights. Eat maror 1 night. Eat maror 2 nights. What's going on here? We're adding to the mitzvahs. Second of all, in many instances, the second day yontif actually means taking away from the mitzvahs. For men particularly, who have a mitzvah every day, every weekday to put on tefillin. Comes the second day yontif, you don't put on tefillin.
And chol ha-moed you put.
No, some people don't put on tefillin chol ha-moed. That's true. But let's say at the end, Simchat Torah, for example, which is, or second day Shavuot, right? Or Achron Shel Pesach, which according to everyone in Eretz Yisrael is a weekday. Everyone will put on tefillin. It's a machleg. In Eretz Yisrael, they don't put on tefillin chol ha-moed. Ashkenazim do, Chassidim don't, Sfaradim don't. That's a whole machleg. It's a separate problem. It's nothing to do with this, but it's a separate issue. It's one of the things that keep Yiddishkeit exciting. One of the great Torah topics. But anyways. Right, but you see what I'm saying. So second day yontif, we add and we take away. Comes along Shabbos. If Rosh Hashanah falls out on Shabbos, the Torah says blow shofar. The rabbis say don't blow shofar. So what's going on here? Do we add or don't we add? And besides, we have many, many things we've added to the Torah. One of the components of Yiddishkeit, we know that when we fulfill mitzvahs, we have three levels. We have the level of Da'araisa, which means biblical mitzvahs. We have rabbinic mitzvahs. And then we have minhagim, customs. Gosh, galore, right? There's more customs than there are mitzvahs.
So it's probably only a certain form can end.
Right, so we need to understand. So we need to clarify what's the definition of this mitzvah. Because the truth is that the question I just asked you is not my question. It's a question that's asked many, many times, and it was asked by one of the Baalei HaTosfos, one of the commentaries on the Gemara, one of Rashi's grandchildren, right? There's a commentary on the Talmud called Tosfos, which is a collection of pieces from what we call the Baalei HaTosfos. It was a group of people called Baalei HaTosfos, and many of them were Rashi's grandchildren. So we're talking about the, 13th century, right? And Tosfos asks the following question. He says, if you have a look at Rosh Hashanah, Rosh Hashanah is coming up soon, right? So it's a good example to give now. If you have a look at Rosh Hashanah, there's a mitzvah to blow shofar. How many sounds of the shofar do you have to blow? Sorry?
30.
30. Why 30? Well, there's three kinds of sounds, right? There's a tzkiyah. There's a tzkiyah, there's a shtruah, there's a shvarim. But if you look at the Torah, I'll just briefly outline how this works, right? If you look at the Torah, there's a mitzvah to blow shofar. 9 sounds. You're supposed to blow tkiah, trua, tkiah, 3 times. That's the mitzvah. Okay, the truth is that over time it develops into 30 sounds because we're not actually sure what the trua is. Right? Is it a trua? Is it a short sound? Is it a more longer sound, what we call shvarim? Is it a combination, shvarim, trua? Alright, so we can understand that we add to the mitzvah in order to cover all bases because we're not sure which formula will be the fulfillment of the mitzvah. But Tosis asks, that's all good, but the truth is we don't only blow 30 sounds, we blow 100 sounds. Right? We blow 100 sounds because we blow...
It's 3 times the 30-something.
More than 3 times the 30. Three times plus an extra 10. We blow Rosh Hashanah twice. We blow right after the reading of the Torah, and then we blow throughout Musaf, right? Now, when we blow after Kriyas HaTorah, it's called Tkiyas Demayushav. It's called the blowing the shofar that you're allowed to sit. And then I'll tell you why I'm saying this in a minute. And then when you blow during Musaf, it's called Tkiyas Demumad. It's blowing the shofar that you have to stand. Right? Now, the Torah, when it said to blow shofar, didn't say when you should blow shofar. You can blow shofar any time. Came along the rabbis, let's say, fine. Okay, so the rabbis wanted us to blow shofar together with davening. So it should bleed together with Musaf, right? But then they came along and said, okay, do it together with Musaf, but also do it before Musaf. So the Gemara asks the question, the Gemara says, why do we blow twice? Why do we blow Keshehein Yoshvin when they're sitting down? And why do they blow when they're standing up? Right, what is this all about? Says the Gemara, Kadei La'arvev Es HaSatan. The Gemara says, it's just to confuse the Satan. Whatever that means, and that requires a different explanation.
That's because people who come late.
Yeah, okay. But that's not what the Gemara says. People come late, that's a different story, we blow for them. But we say everyone has to hear both times. Why? to confuse the Satan. So Tosfos comes and asks the question, he says, okay, it's a very nice thing to confuse the Satan. But what happened with this mitzvah? The mitzvah, you're not allowed to add to the mitzvahs. The Torah says 30 sounds, you make 100. Right? So Tosfos answers the following, and he says that. But he answers something that only answers part of the question. That's why I want to just bring what he says, and then we'll take it further. He says that it's not considered adding to the mitzvah when you do the same mitzvah again. In other words, let's say on the first day Sukkot, right? So you take the lulav and eshog and you lift it up and you fulfill the mitzvah, right? There's nothing stopping you, says Tosfos. Anyone can take the lulav and eshog 100 times if they want on the same day. You want to repeat the mitzvah? That's not adding to the mitzvah. That's just doing the same mitzvah again. And that's not a problem. But let's say, for example, if I were to tell you that there's a new mitzvah now, and that is to take lulav on today, it's not Sukkot, that's called adding to the mitzvah. Right? That's the view of Tosfos. So that's the one answer. But of course, that doesn't really answer the question completely, because we don't only do the same mitzvah more than once during the day. I just gave you the example of lulav, where we do it more than once during other days. Right? Or second day Yom Tov, we eat. Yeah, I mean, there's a mitzvah to eat matzah first night Pesach. So Tosfos was saying, if you want, you can eat matzah 14 times during the first night Pesach. That's okay. But you can't make it a new mitzvah to do this in second night Pesach. So how does that work, right? So some of the other commentaries say like this, and this becomes a little bit of a very, very important foundation. This comes from one of the Rishonim called the Rashba, and it's also explained similarly in the Rambam, right? And that is like this. The Torah gave us a mitzvah not to add and not to take away. Right. The Torah, however, also gave the rabbis a mandate to protect the Torah, to make sure, to safeguard it. Right? That's part of Torah Shabbat Peh. Part of the Oral Torah is that the Sanhedrin, the legislators, the people in charge of Halacha, should have the responsibility of seeing in every generation, particularly when there was a Sanhedrin, where things could become weakened, where things need strengthening, and therefore they were allowed to add or take away from the Torah in order to protect that. So for example, the Rambam gives the following example. We know that it's prohibited from the Torah to eat meat and milk. Right? Which meat and milk is asr? So halakhically, you cannot eat any animal with milk, you cannot eat any wild animal, like a deer with milk. But actually, halakhically, I don't know if you're aware of this, halakhically, you could eat, biblically that is, you could eat chicken with milk. Right? Not a problem. Chicken and cheese sandwich wouldn't be a problem, right? Sorry? Ach is right. Why? Because came along the rabbis, and they saw that if we permit people to eat chicken and meat and milk, because chicken is so similar to meat, how do you know chicken is similar to meat? Because ask any vegetarian, he'll tell you, he doesn't eat meat or chicken, right? Yeah. Might eat fish, but not chicken. So therefore, you see that chicken and meat are very confusable. They're very similar. So therefore, we permit people to eat chicken and milk, they will come eventually to eat meat and milk. So they said prohibited, you're not allowed to eat. Says the Rambam like this. That's not a problem. The rabbis could do that. First of all, it has to be halachically acceptable. And second of all, here comes a very, very important idea. The idea is that the rabbis are allowed to add to the mitzvah and say chicken and milk is also asr, also forbidden. Right? What they cannot do is, they cannot say that the mitzvah of meat and milk in the Torah involves not eating chicken and milk. There's a very big difference. In other words, when they add a fence, it has to be clear that this is the Oraisa, this is biblical, and this is rabbinic. Who made that first mistake? Adam. Right? Adam and Chava made the first mistake, a disastrous mistake. What did he do? Hashem told Adam Arishan, don't eat from the fruit. So he became a Sanhedrin. What did he do? He wanted to make a rabbinic mitzvah. That in order to make sure you don't eat the fruit, you shouldn't even touch the tree. Makes sense. The rabbis do this all the time. His problem was, he didn't tell Chava that. He told Chava that God said not to touch the trees. Came along because the same, and the same prohibition will apply. Because the day you touch the trees, you'll die. Now God didn't say that. God said the day you eat the fruit, you'll die. Came along the snake and said, I'll show you, touch the tree, nothing will happen to you. Right? Now was he confused? What was the biblical mitzvah? What was the rabbinic mitzvah? The same thing. The rabbi says they can come and do that. In fact, not only they can add, and they can add for various reasons. They can add to the mitzvah either to create a precaution. They can add, like in the case of Shofar, to confuse the Satan, whatever that means. They can add to the mitzvah of Lulav and say that it's important because they see it to be important. It's important to know that you have to do something to remember the Beis HaMikdash. And because in the Beis HaMikdash, there was there was 7 days of Lulav, you have to take a Lulav for 7 days. They can say that there's a second day Yontif, right? They can even, the rabbis can even take away a mitzvah, as long as it's clear that it's a rabbinic institution. Now, just interesting, because just for completion of the topic, how does it actually work? When can I take away a mitzvah? Like they do, right? They say we don't put on tefillin the second day Yontif. We don't blow shofar if Yontif is Shabbos. You don't shun a Shabbos. Well, you should be blowing shofar, and the rabbis say not to blow shofar. How does it actually work? It works that, because not everything, the mandate of the rabbinic legislation doesn't, it's not unlimited. For example, the rabbis could never say that you have to eat, you can eat treif. The way it works is, they can even take away from a mitzvah if it's passive. Like, there's a mitzvah to blow shofar, they can say, don't blow shofar. They can put like a halachic wall between you and the shofar that you can't get there, so to speak. Right? So that's when they can even take away. But that taking away is also, it's clear that it's taking away because of a rabbinic precaution. Okay? The same thing when it comes to minhagim, the same thing when it comes to customs. Minhagim are very, very precious. They're very, very important. But it has to be clear what's a minhag and what's not. Now, one should be very careful with this, because what's the purpose of this idea? Why do we actually need to know what's what? It's not because one's stricter than the other. That's actually not true. It's a huge mistake for people to think that I'm allowed to treat a rabbinic mitzvah, for example, with less meticulousness than I treat a biblical mitzvah. That's actually not true. We are taught that we have to actually treat all mitzvahs equally, and if we're obligated to do something, it doesn't matter if it's a biblical mitzvah or a rabbinic mitzvah or a biblical mitzvah or a minhag even, we have to treat it with the same conviction and the same approach and the same enthusiasm. Right? One should never, chas v'sholem, say, it's just a rabbinic mitzvah, it doesn't matter. It's not true. Not only that, the Medrash says that in fact, Hashem says that at a certain level, chavivin alai, rabbinic mitzvah says Hashem, are more precious to me than biblical mitzvahs. And why is that? Because rabbinic mitzvahs, the commentaries explain, represents the initiative that Klal Yisrael takes. It represents our involvement. It means we're not just sitting by passive and doing what we need to do, but we're ready even to add, we're ready to take initiative, we're ready to be creative within the guidelines that Hashem has given us. Right? And that's why minhagim, customs are so important. And customs have been the culture that has kept Klal Yisrael going for all the generations. Because that shows the preciousness. When you do a minhag, shows a minhag is something you don't have to do really. So why have communities accepted upon themselves all sorts of minhagim? Wasn't it enough with all the mitzvahs we had till now? No, because we're excited about Torah mitzvahs and we're into it and we evolve and therefore we create and we develop various customs, right? And therefore customs are very important and very precious. So one shouldn't think that because the Torah is giving us a mitzvah not to add, not to take away, and we're explaining it, that it means you have to be clear what is what, right? Therefore that means that we can be less meticulous with the observance of rabbinic mitzvahs or customs, God forbid. So why do we have a delineation? Why is it so important to know what is what? So there's two reasons. One is because it does sometimes make halachic difference. Right? There are many times it doesn't make halachic difference with regard to, in other words, on a normal approach, one approaches any mitzvah the same. But when a particular question comes up, on Shabbos, for example, on Shabbos it's very important to know. If someone is unwell, there's all sorts of differences halachically between rabbinic prohibitions and biblical prohibitions. On Yom Kippur, on fast days, on all these different things, it's very often important to know what is a rabbinic mitzvah, what is a biblical mitzvah, because they do have different halachas. Not that they're treated differently, but they have different halachas with regard to stringency and strictness, and therefore it's important to know. But on a philosophical level, the Sefer Achinuch says it's important to know because of the following. The reason that we need to know this concept of not adding to a mitzvah, not taking away from a mitzvah, is because we need to understand that the Torah that God gave us is perfect. When you add to a mitzvah or you detract from a mitzvah and you think that that's part of the mitzvah itself, what you're saying is that God's Torah is imperfect. And one of our fundamentals of our belief in Torah Misinai is that the Torah is a blueprint for creation. The Torah is perfect in its entirety. There's nothing wrong with the Torah. There's nothing imperfect with the Torah. The Torah doesn't need trimming. It doesn't need pruning. It doesn't need to be added to. The Torah is a perfect entity in itself. And that's why we have a mitzvah, that we need to understand the biblical mitzvahs as they are and focus on them as they are, because they are perfect in it. Then in addition to that, we have additions that the Chachamim make, and Hagim, for other reasons, for precautions, to protect it. It's all to protect and to preserve that perfect entity. That perfect entity is a perfect entity in itself. Right? So, going back to the Chet Etzadas, had Adam told Chava that Hashem said not to eat the fruit, but I'm suggesting that you don't touch the tree in case you eat the fruit, that would have been very different. Right? But he didn't do that, he confused the two. And therefore the same thing with all of the rabbinic precautions. So the summary of this is as follows. The Torah says not to add to mitzvah, not to add. For example, Rashi says that the Torah says to put four paragraphs in the tefillin, so you can't put five, right? Four corners of tzitzis, you can't put five, that kind of thing. But it also means you can't make a new day, you can't say today there's a mitzvah that's in the sukkah, or that kind of thing. So the Torah says you're not allowed to add, you're not allowed to take away. There are those that have the authority to add and to take away for reasons, like the Chachamim can do it for reasons of precaution or protection or chavivus or remembering the Beis HaMikdash, but as long as it's clear what is the mitzvah and what is the addition. Okay. So that's that mitzvah. I just thought I'd bring it up. It's an interesting mitzvah. We don't often highlight these little details. Okay, let's have a look at something else which is also in the Chumash Parsha. which is the mitzvah of kashrus again. It comes up in Parsha Shmini, and it comes up in Parsha Re'eh, twice in the Torah. Some page. Page 110. At the bottom, Pasuk Gimel, verse 3. Okay, the Pasuk says as follows. Lo yisaychal kol ta'eva. You shouldn't eat anything that's abomination, that's not right. Zois ha'behema asher techelu. This is the animal you can eat. Shoyir, seh, some you eat ox, you eat sheep. Say izim, goats, ayol, v'tzvi, v'yachmor, v'akor, v'dishon, v'soy, v'zomer. Those are the seven wild animals, like deer and buck and things like that. Then says the pasuk the following: V'chol behema mi mafreses parsa. Any animal that has split hoofs, that split hoofs. V'sheisa shesa shtei process, meaning it's completely split all the way. Ma'alas geira ba behema, and it chews the cud. Oiso tachelus. So now these are the two signs of kosher animals: split hoofs and chewing the cud. Anything that isn't that, you cannot do that, right? Okay. Then skip a little bit to pasuk tes. My pasuk. Then the Torah turns to fish. And say, "Ezeh toichlu." This is what you can eat: mikol asher b'moim, and what is in the water. Kol asher loy snapir bekaskeses toichlu. Whatever has fins and scales, you can eat. However, v'chol asher ein lois napir v'kaskeses, whichever does not have fins and scales, lois achel you cannot eat, tomei hu lachem, it is considered impure. It's considered non-kosher. Okay? So those are the two things. It tells us animals that have split hoofs and chew the cud are kosher animals. Fish that have fins and scales are kosher. So I want to share with you an idea, which I don't know if I've ever shared this year. I tend to forget where I share what, so you have to forgive me if it's a review, but it's a beautiful idea. And it's based on a Mishnah. It's based on the following concept, that every time we see, every mitzvah we have in the Torah operates on two levels. We keep all mitzvahs on two levels. One is the physical application of the mitzvah, and then there's a spiritual application of the mitzvah, right? For example, again, to give an analogy from Rosh Hashanah coming up soon, we blow shofar on Rosh Hashanah. So we blow shofar on two levels. One is supposed to blow shofar physically, which means keep all the halachas, pick up a horn and actually blow it, in keeping with all the details that Shulchan Aruch tells us to blow. Then, of course, we need to blow shofar spiritually, which is the idea of tshuva and the cry that comes from the essence of the soul, etc., etc. And that's true with every mitzvah. There are some mitzvahs that we cannot keep physically today, like the mitzvah of bringing sacrifices and these type of things, because they apply only to the temple, to the Beis HaMikdash. So those mitzvahs we only keep spiritually. Right? And that's important to know. In other words, all the mitzvahs apply today, but just some of them don't apply physically, only apply spiritually. But all mitzvahs apply spiritually. And therefore, this mitzvah of kashrus also, there's this concept of kashrus, of kosherness within our soul. Right? And the Torah, when it gives us signs of kashrus, it's not just signs for animals and for fish. These signs represent various ideas. I'm just trying to understand what is it, what do they represent, or what is the meaning behind these signs of split hooves and chew the cud and fins and scales. So there's a very interesting Mishnah where the Mishnah talks about the fish and the thing. And the Mishnah says the following. The Mishnah says, with regard to fish, any fish that has scales has fins. Okay, that's an interesting halachic thing. If you find a fish that's got scales, you don't have to check that it's got fins. If it has scales, it means automatically kosher, because a fish cannot have fins without scales. So if it's got scales, it cannot have scales without fins, that's what I mean. So if it's got scales, it's got fins. However, says the Mishnah, not every fish that has fins has scales. So if you discover a fish that has fins and there's no scales, it doesn't mean it's a kosher fish, it doesn't mean the scales were there and they fell off. It could be it didn't have scales, so therefore you're not allowed to eat the fish. Okay. And of course that in itself creates a question, because the Gemara asks the question, if that's the case, why does the Torah tell us that the signs of a kosher fish is fins and scales. It just needed to say scales. Right? Really, one of them is enough, because scales would have, it wasn't necessary if that was irrelevant to tell us fins. So the Gemara says various answers. One of the answers is L'hag l'tor l'adir, the Torah wanted to make the Torah bigger, wanted to teach us that it's teaching us a concept even though it's not that practically relevant, because the Torah, it's Torah, it's rich in its own right, and we need to understand it. Okay. So that's what it says about regard to fish. Then when it comes to animals, it says the following. Apparently, all kosher animals, those that have split feet and shoe the cud, have horns. Sorry. Other way around. Apparently, any animal that has horns, big horns, are kosher animals. Okay? In other words, animals that don't have split feet and chew the cud do not have horns. Do you know that? I'm not a zoologist, I don't know these things. I'm just telling you what the Mishnah tells us. Okay? So the Mishnah says the following. This is the words of the Mishnah. Any animal that has horns has split feet. But not every animal that has split feet has horns. Okay? Because horns... No.
So we see, Kitty, animals without horns.
Actually, it's not like that, because apparently if it has split feet and has chews the cud, it'll also have horns. That's where it goes. But it could have split... For example, a pig has split feet, but doesn't chew the cud. It doesn't have horns. Right? But it's a fact the Mishnah says. So we need to understand what is the significance of this. Okay, with fish we understand. With fish, the significance is because we need to know. If you see a fish with scales, so it automatically means it's kosher because it has scales and fins. But horns was never one of the signs. So how come that? What's the significance of the Mishnah? So, a number of years ago, they found, after the Lubavitcher Rebbe passed away, they found in his drawer a book of notes. It's called Rishimus. And these were very shorthand notes that he made for himself, that many of them were never published, and many of them he never spoke about. He was intending to speak about, maybe, but never spoke about. And one of these notes, and they published them afterwards. And in one of these notes, there's a fascinating explanation of this Mishnah, a spiritual explanation of this Mishnah, that is a real incredible understanding of the whole idea of the signs of kashrus of the fish and the animals. And he says the following. He says, first of all, fish and animals represent two types of Jews. Or, not just two types of Jews, but two types of experiences. What do I mean? Fish are in the water, and animals on dry land. Now, we know from many, many different places, water always represents spirituality, right? Water is the Torah. The Torah is compared to water. Someone who's immersed in Torah, it's like the Rambam says, like going to mikveh, it's like being immersed in water. Right, so the Torah, being immersed in a spiritual experience, is comparable to being underwater. It's being connected, because water is a symbol of life. It's being connected to life, etc. Dry land is detached from the water. In other words, when you're on dry land, you're not next to the water. Right. So there's two types of people. In fact, not only there's two types of people, but within every one of us, there's two types of people. There's two experiences. But we find this also with Klal Yisrael, that there are two types of individuals. There are those individuals that their role is to be involved completely in spirituality. The tzaddikim, the Rashi Yeshivas, the people who learn Torah all day. Right? These are the people that their role about their tachlis is to be involved in spirituality. And those are like the fish. And then you have the people who are detached from that world and spend most of their time out there in the physical, mundane world. And those are like the animals outside of the water. More important, let's apply to ourselves. Every person is supposed to have those two experiences. Every person is supposed to have parts of our lives where we're completely involved in spirituality. So we have the times of our lives where we shut off from the world and we come to a shir, we learn Torah, and we immerse ourselves in the spiritual experience of learning Torah, or keeping mitzvahs, or davening, or whatever the case is, shutting ourselves away and escaping from the distractions of the physical world. That's like the fish experience. And then there's experiences where we detach ourselves from that world and we go back into the physical world, and we should, because that we have a role to play there. We have to elevate the physical world, we have to bring Hashem into the physical world, and we have to operate within the world where God is concealed, where God is hidden, where it's a much more physical and down-to-earth and mundane experience. And in each experience, there are signs of kashrus. Signs of kashrus means to know if you're spiritually surviving that experience. So he says the following. Let's take the fish experience. One of the things we know when someone learns Torah is an unbelievable spiritual experience. But when can that experience affect a person positively? The Gemara says a funny thing. The Gemara says that Torah is like a potion, it's like an ointment. And the Gemara says that if you merit, the Torah will become a potion of life. If you don't, it will become a poison. The very same Torah that is so holy, that is so pure, that is so powerful, can actually be a negative, can have a negative effect on a person. How? If a person is arrogant, if a person doesn't have fear of heaven, when a person is involved in a spiritual experience, if he comes to that spiritual experience with arrogance, with ego, then the spiritual experience will not affect that person. On the contrary, it could be detrimental for the person. It will feed his arrogance. Right? We know that when we are taught that when one learns Torah, Torah has to be studied together with Yirat Shamayim, with fear of heaven. One has to immerse oneself in that Torah with a protective shield, a spiritual protective shield of attachment to God, humility and fear of heaven. That is the concept of the scales. The scales is like the protection over the fish. The fish is the animal that swims in the water, spiritually symbolizing the person that is swimming and immersed in a spiritual experience. But if a person to be kosher has to swim with that protective shield, has to swim with the protection, with the scales around the skin. That's what scales represent. What do the fins represent? So the Gemara tells us, what are fins? Fins enable the fish to swim very quickly. What the fins enable the fish to do is to go from point A to point B with a great leap, with one swish, right? What does that symbolize? That symbolizes the concept of creativity. We are taught that when we immerse in Torah, when we learn Torah, we're supposed to be creative. We're supposed to make chidushim. We're supposed to ask questions, be innovative, come up with new ideas, right? We're supposed to think for ourselves. We're supposed to ask questions. We're supposed to submit theories. That's why we have libraries and libraries of people who learn Torah who are able to come up with their own novel ideas, because that's what you're supposed to do. The Zohar says that Torah is not just a passive thing, it's not just a prescriptive thing. Torah has infinite potential. Anyone who learns Torah on any level has the right and the ability and the obligation to create new thoughts and new ideas. One has to swim, one has to grow. The problem is that sometimes if you grow and you swim and you're creative, you can be creative in the wrong way. There are many people who create new thoughts in Torah that those thoughts are very creative, but they're totally off the track. They're totally not in line with the purity of Torah, with the authority of Torah. As soon as you start, the more creative you're being, the more dangerous it is to come up with ideas and thoughts that are completely contrary to the real essence and purity of Torah. Nevertheless, on the other hand, a person must be creative. That's what Hashem wants from us. So therefore, that's the sign of a kosher fish. That's what the Mishnah says. The Mishnah says as follows. Not every fish that has fins has scales. In other words, the fact that a person is very clever, the fact that a person has the ability to be creative and to come up with new and deep and novel thoughts in the spiritual experiences that he or she engages in, it does not necessarily mean that it's correct. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's on the right track. It could be, chas v'shalom, that a person can do that, but without the scales, without the Yirat Shamayim, without the fear of heaven. And it could be swimming, but swimming in the wrong direction. But, on the other hand, every fish that has scales, if a person engages in a spiritual experience, l'shem Shamayim, if a person engages in a spiritual experience with a protective shield of Yirat Shamayim, a fear of heaven, of really being connected, such a person, Hashem, will always give the ability to swim, to grow and to be creative. If you have scales, you have fins. Fins not necessarily have scales. Scales automatically bring to fins. Fins don't automatically bring to scales. So the first step, therefore, when you approach a spiritual experience, the first step, the most important step, is the protection, the spiritual protection. Right? So that's the person engaged in spirituality. Then the person leaves the world of spirituality. Right? Leaves the water and becomes an animal, not a fish. And now is the person engaging with the world. And the world is challenging. And the question always is, how does one reach kashrut? How does one stay kosher? How does one remain connected and survive the spiritual challenges that present itself in the wide world. So he explains the following. He says there are two simanim of kashrus. There are two signs of kashrus. There are split hooves and they are chewing the cud. What do those two signs represent? So the split hooves represent two concepts, two very fundamental concepts that a person has to know, that they have to have in order to survive being involved in the physical world. The first thing is that what is a hoof? A hoof is a separation. It's a separation between us and the earth. Right? In order for us to survive in the physical world, in the material world, we have to create for ourselves an imaginary, a virtual separation between us and the world. You know, that's the idea. The Gemara says that a person, that shoes is so important that a person should sell everything they have to buy a pair of shoes. That's what the Gemara says. Why? Because what does it mean? Shoes represent something. They represent the separation between us and the earth. Right? We can only survive and we can only thrive in the physical and material surrounding if we always remember that separation. If we always remember that there's always a barrier between us and materialism. Then we can make the materialism work for us spiritually. Then we can elevate it. Then we can infuse it with Kedusha. But the moment we become too comfortable in the material surroundings and we connect with it without a separation, without knowing that there's a Havadolah, there's something separating between us and the material surrounding, there's something different about us and the material surroundings, we're in trouble. So step one to spiritual survival is to have a hoof. It's got to be a separation between us and the floor, between us and the earthliness, so to speak. The second thing is that that hoof has to be split. Why? Because the concept of split hoof is the concept that we've talked about many times. That when you split a hoof all the way up, there's two sides, there's the right and there's the left. There's chesed and there's gvura. In order to survive spiritually and to grow spiritually in any environment, it's only possible if a person is always ready to do things that are against their personality and their nature. Right? Every person has a nature, one person's personality. We've spoken about this many, many times. Most people are disposed either to chesed or to gvura. Most people are either chesed people or gvura people. Avraham was chesed, Yitzchak was gvura, etc. But a person knows, in order to, that's how a person is born. But in order for us to grow, and grow spiritually particularly, we have to have split hooves. We have to know that there always has to be two coving, two sides. There's always going to be a readiness that if the call of the hour would demand it, we have to do things that are contrary to the way we normally are, contrary to our personality. So if we are chesed people, then sometimes we're going to have the strength of gevura, the discipline of gevura. If we're gevura people, we're disciplined, reliable, organized people, sometimes we're going to have the flexibility and the compassion of chesed. If a person only follows their own personality, even if they start off well, but they become non-kosher, because the call of the hour will always, at some stage, demand that we do things that are contrary to our personality. So that's the first simon of kashrus. You've got to have split hooves. The chewing the cud, let's explain what's chewing the cud. What does chewing the cud actually mean? It means when an animal eats, they eat it again. Right? That's what it essentially means. They bring it up and eat it again. Right? It's constant processing. What chewing the cud represents in terms of our own spiritual kashrus is that we always have to question. We always have to review. When we're involved in the world of spirituality, things are a lot clearer. As soon as we go into the world of Gashmi, as soon as we go into the world of materialism, there are always grey areas, there are always challenges, there are always questions. And we have to keep reviewing. What was clear yesterday is not clear today. The answer to the question we got yesterday is not the answer to the question we have today. We have to keep thinking about, we have to keep reflecting, we have to keep reviewing, we have to keep on our toes and keep asking the question, is what I'm doing is right? Am I going too far? Am I not going enough? Am I right? Because there's, when we're involved in the physical world, there's always the fine line. There's always the real tightrope experience to be able to really navigate our way through the grey areas and the challenges and the complexities of the questions that come up in that type of experience. And that's why we have to chew the cud. We have to keep on asking. A question we asked last week is a question we have to ask again today. Something we thought about last week is something we have to think about today. And that's the only way we can actually survive. What do horns represent? Horns represent, we are told, the horns, the highest part of the animal. The horns is the shlemus, the perfection, the survival. When a person can actually show and demonstrate at the end of their life, they really survived, they've really been able to reach a level of perfection by going through that challenge of being involved in the physical world. Because if a person goes through the mundane experience of this material world and survives, they reach a much higher level than ever encountering it to begin with. In other words, someone that a neshama that never comes down to this physical world can never reach a level that a neshama comes down to this world can reach. Because a neshama comes down to this world and has the challenges of this world and survives them, ends up being much higher and much more perfect than the neshama that never experienced that to begin with. Right? So therefore, that's what the Mishnah says. Mishnah says like this: if someone has reached perfection, if someone has survived, then you know, if you see horns, you can know for sure that there were split hooves and there was chewing the cud. Because a person can never, says the Mishnah, a person can never reach perfection without those ingredients. It's impossible. If you didn't have those ingredients, you would never have the horns. You would never reach perfection. You would never reach that strength. Because those two simanim, those two signs are so critical that without them it's impossible to reach any level of perfection in this world. And therefore, if you see an animal that has horns, it's guaranteed that they have split hooves and they chew the cud. But if you see an animal with split hooves, it might be taking the first step. That might be creating the barrier between them and the world around them, but there's a long way to go. So it doesn't mean that anyone who has split hooves has necessarily reached perfection. In fact, there's a lot of other things to do. That we know that the chazer, what we all consider the most trafe animal, has split hooves.
So how come? If it's the most, how come he doesn't have one sign of kashrut?
He has one sign. What? Sorry? Oh, why? No, first of all, it's a bit of a mistake that he's the most trafe, because it's actually not true. It just happens to be a symbol because it's a dirty animal. I don't know exactly, right? But actually, it's not more trafe than anything else, right? In the laws of kashrut, it's not actually true. In the laws of kashrut, there are things that are much more trafe than a pig, right? But actually, it doesn't make a difference, because it's an interesting lesson, the chazir. The chazir is the person who represents the person who is ready to make that separation, is ready to go against the personality, but they're not ready to review, they're not ready to reflect, they're not ready to ask questions. And at the end of the day, it doesn't work, so they become treif anyway, right? So in other words, not everyone has split hooves necessarily has reached perfection, therefore not everyone has split hooves has horns. But if you have horns, horns cannot happen, perfection cannot happen without those two ingredients. So that's why, that's the deep pshat in this Mishnah. So when it comes to people involved in spiritual experiences, if they have the protection of the fins, of the scale, sorry, they'll definitely be able to reach the creativity and the focused reactivity of spiritual experiences. If they have fins, it doesn't mean they have scales, because the Yirat Shamayim, fear of heaven, the protection, is so important when you engage in spiritual experiences, to get rid of the ego, to be connected to Hashem, and that's the only way spiritual immersion will have an effect on us. And when it comes to being leaving that world and being involved in the wider world, it only works if you're ready to make that separation, if you're ready to go against your personality, to be both chesed and gevura, and if you're ready to always reflect and review. So that's the deeper pshat in the mitzvah of kashrus. Okay, I think we'll stop there, because we have time a lot.
Thank you very much.
Good.
Thank you.